Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of Living on Blockchain. Today we are speaking to Ali from Blockchain Founders Fund. He's the managing partner there. They invest heavily in early stage Web3 startups. He's also a limited partner at Loyal VC and Draper Grorin Home. Ali consults organizations on emerging technologies, as he's also working with the UN in trying to build solutions which are at the intersection of technology and help out in alleviating poverty. He has served as a senior blockchain fellow at INSEAD as well, and he has been recognized as a global leader in the blockchain space. He is an acclaimed author as well as a columnist, and he has worked basically extensively at both ends. He had a startup at some point, and now he's an investor. This was a highly insightful conversation, talking a lot about how Blockchain Founders Fund helps entrepreneurs reach and build on their vision, and also his own thesis regarding where the market is heading, the kind of spaces that are doing well. So for all builders out there, especially, I think this would be a very insightful conversation. I can't wait for you guys to hear this. Let's deep dive right in.
Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing, Ali?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully well. I'm so glad that we could make the time to speak to each other finally. This comes after a bunch of reschedules, some from my end, some from your end. But I'm just really grateful that you could make the time.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And thanks for having me on the show.
So you have an impressive background with extensive experience in blockchain, you know, venture capital and technology. Can you tell us a little bit more about your journey and how you got involved in the Web3 space?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been quite the journey. Let's call it that. Lots of up and downs. But, you know, I think it goes back, you know, even to, you know, the way I sort of grew up. And I think one of the big things when people saw Bitcoin, you know, fairly early on, I think a lot of people were turned off by it, didn't understand it, didn't understand the potential. And I think what was maybe different in sort of my case specifically is, you know, I grew up in Vancouver, but my parents are actually refugees from East Africa. And I think that really shaped and helped me understand like instability in the world, instability in regions, understanding, you know, how things can sort of get taken away from, you know, just poor monetary systems, things like that. And, you know, Bitcoin really changed that narrative, right? And it sort of underscored what happens or what sort of could be the counter to, you know, governments that are, you know, that have poor sort of economic systems designs or just taking advantage of their central banks, et cetera. And sort of after then getting involved sort of on Bitcoin, ended up launching a startup later on in the Web3 space. So that was in 2016. We started an exchange at the time. We raised a few rounds of capital, grew a team of 40 people. And after exiting that, ended up starting Blockchain Founders Fund. So since 2017, we've been running Blockchain Founders Fund. So it's now 7 years. We have got over 130 portfolio companies. So if we fast forward, right, that's a lot of companies that we've backed, a lot of incredible founders that are reshaping, you know, the space and reshaping sort of the way that the industry and even the world works.
That's wonderful. And that's quite an impressive portfolio of number of companies that, you know, you guys have invested in. So let's delve a little bit more into that, you know, a little more into Blockchain Founders Fund. What kind of inspired you to create it, and how does it differentiate itself from, you know, other blockchain ventures that are actually, you know, exclusively investing in Web3?
Yeah, so I mean, so just sort of to make sure I sort of got the question, you're sort of asking about companies that sort of exclusively invest in Web3 and sort of why. Is that accurate?
So yeah, you can cover that. But what I do want to know is how did you sort of get inspired to launch this? Because you were working on your startup earlier, like you mentioned. And how do you differentiate yourself? Or is there a USP if the founder is sort of going with your fund when they are looking for investment?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, I mean, there's definitely a big differentiation, right? I think most founders that have raised capital before would know that, you know, a lot of VCs don't necessarily, you know, add value, help open up doors.
Yeah, it's dumb
you
money.
Know, founders, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not necessarily. I mean, I think there's still different classifications, right? But I think there's still a big difference in the Web3 space where, being able to have someone to open up doors, whether that's like, exchanges, market makers, a lot of like very strategic backers in the space or leading funds in the space, et cetera, that, you'd want that sort of support to open up those doors. Or even when you think about like rolling up sleeves and figuring out go to market, et cetera. I think those are sort of very critical aspects. And so, that those are the types of things we do with our companies, right? So even with the vast majority of our companies, we'll end up driving and supporting this in terms of like helping to bring in a lot of co-investors, helping to, bring in customers on the product and driving up revenues, and sort of key partnerships. So those are sort of all of the areas that we get involved in, for the most part, right?
Absolutely, I think I concur there. So that is perhaps your major USP when it comes to attracting great founders.
Absolutely. Yeah, so those would be the key things. I mean, also there's always going to be areas where like, companies need support on, key hires, stuff like that, which are the things we get involved in. I mean, one of the things we pride ourselves on is we want to be the first place where founders come to when they have a challenge as well, right? So if you're like, what you oftentimes see is, founders are sometimes like nervous to go to their investors, let them know about challenges. But, we don't want our founders to think of us as their investors. We want them to think of us as their partners. And like, we just roll up our sleeves with you and figure out how to solve it and move forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you guys have a venture building approach, right? Can you elaborate on how your go-to-market focuses more on the venture program that supports entrepreneurs, especially those navigating the complex landscape of emerging technologies like blockchain, Web3, and metaverse? These are all newer sectors that have, relatively newer sectors that are there. And how do you kind of stay ahead of the curve, and how do you make sure that, you're able to help these founders with their product market fit and their go-to-market?
Yeah, so the venture program sort of applies in some cases on investments for us, right? So when a founder's like very early on in their journey, if they sort of we see still a lot of gaps where we can support them, but we see a lot of very strong strengths on the company where they already have certain parts covered really, really well. Like those are sort of aspects where it makes sense on the venture program side. I mean, we do also invest in a lot of startups that aren't part of our venture program if we think that they're extremely strong and there's just smaller things that we can support them on to sort of help supercharge, right? So there's sort of both aspects. In terms of where we sort of see founders fitting that, we got a lot of really great founders that, bring incredible credibility from traditional industries, but that, really like the Web3 space, have been involved a little bit in the Web3 space. And then we can sort of help to supercharge that, help them navigate this space, help them sort of like get this off the ground or sort of supercharge in that way. And so that's kind of where the venture program really falls in. I mean, in addition to that, we've got about 150 corporate partners that support our companies. We've got 350 experts that support our companies. And so that's where, we see sort of the big impact there.
Wonderful. So it's a very hands-on approach that you guys basically undertake to help the entrepreneurs get things off the ground.
Exactly.
Brilliant. So, your fund emphasizes basically, it focuses a little on early stage investments, right? Could you share some insights perhaps into the key areas or sectors within the blockchain space that you find very promising, where and where you see significant growth potential?
Yeah, so those areas, change a fair bit, right? So, if we go back to 2017, some of the areas that we were focused on are no longer sort of as relevant or as much opportunity anymore as there was before, right? And so, we do have a pretty fluid set of thesis. We have about 25 open thesis right now or sub thesis that we think there's major problems in the Web3 space and no market leader or big opportunities. And so the areas that we're looking for companies in as well does change over time and depends on sort of what that market landscape so looks like at that point.
But I would nevertheless question ask you what particular sector do you feel is doing well and is going to do well in the coming months with this bull market?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can share some of the recent sort of sub-thesis that we've been interested in, right? So, I mean, we still see, some gaps on layer one infrastructure. If you take, say, like decentralized physical infrastructure, or you take, you could even take things like intents, which I can talk about, where we see sort of opportunities around even like real world assets in a layer one related to that or things like this. There's definitely a number of different areas around that from a layer one infrastructure perspective. We do still really like tooling. We think that there's huge opportunities right now on still solving some of the challenges around, things like how do you develop more effectively or multi-chain layer zero protocol, stuff like this, that we see opportunities on. And then some of the more recent sort of investments have been around the themes of like real world assets. So how do you fix problems of on-chain yields and bring sort of more stable, more exciting, I think, yield opportunities on Web3 or on blockchain. We've been investing in things around like decentralized physical infrastructure. So, that sort of allows people to then contribute to these networks more effectively that already have those resources. And then, intents is sort of more around, if X and Y happen, I want to execute Z. So it's kind of like based on certain actions that happen in the market or certain factors, then like I'd want to do some other action. And we think that's quite interesting. We think this has the potential to sort of start consuming OTC markets and other aspects within the Web3 space. We just invest in a really cool company that's doing, for example, liquidation protection. And so crypto trading is still a big use case for crypto as a whole. It's probably the biggest use case. And so we think that's an interesting one. But then there's all sorts of other ones that I'd say are more sort of like how do you bring sort of the traditional enterprises into Web3 more effectively? And so, we've invested, for example, in a company called Petastic that's putting pets on chain. They put about 1 million pets on chain now and building pet IDs. And this solves a number of challenges around sort of paper-based vaccine certificates and things like this. So there's a lot of really exciting things, I think, in all of these different areas. And so, that's partially why, we've been so focused on a number of these different areas.
Wow, nice, wonderful. So I completely agree. I think the kind of use cases that we are seeing currently, they're very exciting, because initially I think the technology itself is exciting for the builders and for perhaps people who are peering in from the outside. But now with these relevant use cases that actually are adding value to the user's life and they become, sticky in nature, that is, I think that is like we are paving the path for mass adoption via this. And that is what makes this space so exciting at this time and age.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a little about some success stories of the startups that you guys have supported? And if you could highlight like the growth of these tech startups, it'd be wonderful and very, very motivating as well for the other entrepreneurs who are listening in.
Yeah, I would be happy to. So, we, for example, in 2019, we were one of the first investors at the intersection of blockchain, AI, and gaming. And at the time, people thought this was a little bit crazy, right? And there wasn't really much investment into, say, like AI at the time. It wasn't like what it is right now, right? And especially when you start blending that with gaming and Web3. There was a lot of concerns from a lot of people, and we backed a startup called Altered State Machine. Altered State Machine had a lot of really, really cool things that they were doing, but in particular, one of those was like, how do you bring uniqueness? If you think about uniqueness in the way that, say, like human DNA works and how humans are unique from one another, and how do you bring that uniqueness into gaming? People just didn't get it, right? And we thought this was fascinating, and so we actually back this right at the start. We're on the founding cap table, so we're literally day from the day zero. And Altered State Machine ended up getting acquired for a pretty strong amount, about 6 months or so, by Futureverse. And that's done really, really well for us. But it's been, quite the journey. I think it took a couple of years till people really started to figure out the potential here. And then it really sort of blew up, I think, over the last couple of years. We ended up launching the first AI football league with FIFA and a number of other really incredible partners. So that was, you know, a pretty exciting one. Some other recent ones that I think are doing really well, and that, you know, again, I think people didn't necessarily believe in the vision of the founder at the start. For example, one is Breshna. And Breshna is a superstar female founder who's out of Washington, D.C. And she's her goal is basically to build a platform where anyone can build a video game in under 10 to 15 minutes. And, you know, at the start when we backed it, there wasn't really many games made. But fast forward now, she's gotten about more than 150,000 games created. They've got about 2 million users that have played these games. And, you know, you see how far it's come is sort of, you know, night and day. But she's ended up with a lot of really incredible backers, from Paris Hilton to Randy Zuckerberg, a number of other sort of heavyweights on our cap table as well now. So, you know, when you back a company that early and then you start seeing sort of the journey, and, you know, you actually see the things that were sort of in that vision come to fruition, and some of it, you know, even a lot faster, a lot bigger than originally expected. It's, you know, it's quite nice to see in sort of a fairly short timeline.
Absolutely. I think that is that is the payoff, right? And it is very, very exciting to be able to support a startup that is doing great things. Obviously, initially when they do, you know, it's a bit of a educated gamble that any investor or even a founder takes. But when it does well, and, you know, all the blood, sweat, and tears basically adds up to some credible value that is being added to the end user's life. It's wonderful to see.
I agree, and that's why we do what we do.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, you're actually involved as a mentor as well with several startups and Orbit Starts and mobile-only accelerators. How do you see mentorship playing a crucial role in the development of startups? And what advice do you often find yourself giving to emerging entrepreneurs in the blockchain space? And this would, again, help, you know, fellow builders in the space who are just starting off.
Yeah, so, I mean, I do think that mentorship is very important. And I think it sort of goes both ways, right? So, I mean, there's one side of the mentor, but I think there's also the side of you know, the coachee, or whether that's the startup founder, that, you know, also needs to be able to take this advice and then, like, sift through it, filter it, figure out, like, what pieces to keep and what pieces to not keep, right? Because what you're going to realize as a startup founder, and any of the startup founders on here listening, I'm sure you'll know, you know, you talk to three different investors or three different mentors, and they give you three different pieces of advice that are completely different, right? And
yeah, you know, yeah,
part of it is, you know, the coachability and, like, being able to take parts that make sense and or even understand what doesn't make sense and why they're saying it, and maybe, like, once you understand it, then determine, you know, do you keep that or discard that? But, you know, it's important to be able to sift through it. If you listen to everyone, it's a bad thing, right? Because, you know, you're going to go in every direction and it'll keep changing. If you listen to no one, it's a bad thing, because that means you're probably not flexible. That probably also translates to not listening to your customers, which also creates other issues. And there's some balance in the middle that sort of makes a lot of sense. In terms of, you know, certain piece of advice, I mean, I think there's all sorts of things, but if you're a founder out there that's, you know, raising, I think there's generally, I find a lot of gaps for founders that are first time founders that haven't raised before. And I think there's a few specific, you know, pieces of advice I could probably give you. One, you know, when you're trying to get to investors, I think one is just making sure that you've got, like, a very concise approach, right? So, you know, one, you can explain your what you guys do or what your company does. And we say in 11, 30, and 90 seconds, right? So those are the three sort of time frames we think you should be able to explain your company in. If it takes you 20 minutes, like, something's wrong, right? You need to be able to explain it in 90 seconds. That doesn't mean you can't do a 30-minute or 20-minute call with someone or a meeting with someone, but it's essentially those are your modular talking points if you think about it, right? So, like, I think that's a very important part. I think the second piece that I see is, like, with pitch decks, these, like, very lengthy pitch decks are probably, like, 10 words per slide or something like that, right? It doesn't need to be crazy wordy. You should be able to get across across what you're working on in a very concise manner. And you know, one of the misconceptions people think is, hey, you're going to raise money off your pitch deck, right? That's not what it's for, right? It's actually for getting a meeting, right? Like no one's invested by seeing a pitch deck and then invest, right? It's like, that's your sort of in to get on a call or get on a meeting. I think it's important to sort of keep that in mind. And if you want a really good tool that you can use as a founder, there's a website called pitchleague.ai. And you can actually upload your pitch deck, and you'll get instant feedback from an AI tool that's actually quite valuable. And so it's a really good starting point as well to figure out.
So I wanted to really ask you about, I read up a little about how you are involved with the UN and you've been working on solutions to elevate poverty through emerging technologies. Can you share some insights into how blockchain and other related technologies can contribute to addressing this particular global challenge in terms of moving people out of poverty and towards perhaps some amounts of prosperity?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a topic that's, extremely impactful. It's something near and dear to my heart. And, you know, you look at this technology and you think about it in a number of ways, right? So all the way from one, like charitable aspects and transparency within charities and why, you know, I think there's fatigue on things around charitable giving is because oftentimes like the money isn't getting there. There's a lack of transparency getting back and forth of information. And you're more likely to donate and donate more if you actually have, I think, a better data sort of transfer or communication between the donor and the cause, or like what's actually happening, what's the impact, maybe even like in the future, in the longer run, we can be real time or close to real time, even on some of the impact, right? Depending on obviously what it is. But I think that's like one aspect. But if you think about even probably the biggest tool for alleviating poverty in history, in reality, it's probably fintech and building and prosperity, right? And, you know, if you take that as an example, right, it's like China's renaissance and taking 900 million people out of poverty, for example, in the last few decades. And, you know, you see things like that. And, you know, I think blockchain really even amplifies that and actually makes it even easier, right? Because you think about the instability around the world. We started off the conversation even about, you know, central banks, and you see firsthand inflation around the world and some places in, you know, essentially hyperinflation, right?
Right.
And, you know, these are things where people are basically losing their livelihood daily from their currencies. And so being able to, one, have a digital native currency that, you know, you can have as a store of value already is, you know, life-saving or life-changing for you. But then, you know, you think about our existing system that we have around the world, and we've got 1 billion people that can't access the banking system, right? And these are very big problems that, you know, aren't being solved fast enough or effectively. And so, you know, when you think about what blockchain can bring, and just, you know, as some of these things get better from a UI UX perspective, we've already got tools that bring you borrowing, lending, savings products. You know, you're able to then interact much more effectively with the system without maybe even an identity, because your government doesn't issue an identity, or like an identity that's recognized, or because you're in a country that, you know, other countries don't want to work with, and therefore your banks aren't able to work with international banks, and therefore it becomes a more like a bigger and bigger problem, right? So like there's all of these different challenges when you think about like, you know, in the sort of global banking financial system. And so there's a lot of really, really exciting opportunities when you start putting in, you know, how blockchain can help achieve these UN Sustainable Development Goals and help alleviate poverty, you know, and then there's even benefits on different aspects from education, you know, when you bring in AI, when you bring in blockchain, and some of these technologies really transform the way of learning, really bring and level the playing field much more, you know, between the developing world and the developed world. So I think there's just a lot of really, really high impact aspects here of this technology, especially when you start pairing it at the intersection of other technologies, right? So we believe that real true value is unlocked when you put, you know, technologies together at key inflection points. And that would be like, for example, like AI and blockchain right now as an example. You've got, you know, AI and even like, and IoT, it starts making a lot of sense when you want to start creating even like more access to internet and remote places or other things can start being quite effective. So that would be just a couple of examples.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, blockchain technology, as you mentioned, that, you know, along with the putting it in the intersection of other technologies can really address these global challenges. Can you give us like a you know, example or a use case? I know that there are many ventures and very many startups that are trying to resolve the, you know, banking the unbanked problem statement in several continents. But is there one particular example that you can give us that thoroughly shows how, you know, really blockchain technology can help in addressing these problems?
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely a number of different ones. I mean, I would say right now, like the biggest impact you're seeing and why you're seeing it so much in all of these different developing regions is you're seeing Bitcoin really taking off and then USDT or USDC, but primarily USDT in emerging markets. Some of them are like DAI and other stable coins, but you know, that just inherently being able to have something that's not eroding 2% a day or 1% a day is already life-saving or game-changing, right? And that's like in a very basic form. What we're seeing then is how that translates into things like credit and being able to access credit and loans based on like history and other things, but in a system where that infrastructure of lending or centralized lending records is not there, right? So credit bureaus, things like that. And, you know, being able to almost build alternative ways to oversee these things using, you know, AI and blockchain and able to really, I think, unlock lending and borrowing for people, which then allows them to fund like a business and like sort of employ more people and sort of, you know, all of that starts to compound and make a difference.
Absolutely. This is wonderful because this is, I think it's addressing such a real problem, and this kind of adds more merit to the technology itself, because there are a lot of naysayers, like at least there were a few years ago for this particular technology, because they were primarily viewing it from the scope of, you know, just these tokens and looking at it as a Ponzi scheme. So when there are these real use cases and sticky use cases, might I add, I think that perception also changes for the better. And only then can we really look at something which is anything close to mass adoption.
Absolutely.
You're a columnist as well, right? You've written for a lot of Web3 publications. You've written several books, and you seem to have your finger on the pulse of the latest trends in the space. What are your thoughts on how the space has kind of evolved? You've been around for a while in this space. How do you see it shaping the future of the internet and beyond?
Yeah, it's been quite the journey, right? So if you go back to earlier in the sort of crypto, you know, phases where there was, say, a lot of hype, even if you go to, say, 2017, right? There was a lot of promises, but a lot of hype on those promises. But it was very early days. And so a lot of the innovation was just, you know, people excited about being able to invest in a decentralized token, right? And that created that whole sort of ICO boom, really created I think a lot of ideas, right? And a lot of people had these visions and ideas, but not a lot was necessarily built in that time frame, in the sense that like a lot of this was people promising it, and then it, you know, they either sort of went under or ran away or whatever, or they built then in sort of the 2018, 2019, and that sort of those bear market sort of years, if they stuck around. And you know, that I think lacked a lot of substance, even though it had sort of these great grand visions. And then we saw sort of fast forward, we saw the launch of a number of interesting, say, layer ones and, you know, other interesting companies launched over the bear market or sort of, you know, survived through that. And then, you know, then you saw in this last previous bull market in 2021, you started seeing, I think, aspects around, you know, all sorts of different use cases on these different chains. And then you saw like the NFT boom, and then that just sort of Axie as well, sort of taking advantage of that. And you saw something similar on the finance side with people getting strong yields in tools like Celsius, BlockFi, I mean, even FTX. And then that all sort of collapsed, right? And
Right.
those players hurt a lot of people, especially those centralized finance players, which aren't really true blockchain, right? So when you think about it, they're not decentralized. You do have that massive sort of single point of failure. So it's not even really following the principles of Web3, but in some ways it was masquerading as like a Web3 company and like a blockchain company. And while it was serving the blockchain industry, it wasn't itself like blockchain native, let's call it. And I think a lot of people got confused or sort of mistaken with that, and obviously got hurt in that situation. And then you had a lot of people leave the industry between 2022 or end of 21 and through 22, and the people that stuck around had really strong belief and kept believing and building incredible products that people would use. And now we're starting to see all sorts of really great sort of multi-chain products. We're seeing a lot of the major problems in the space being solved. You're seeing interesting like real world problems being solved and starting to be solved with blockchain as sort of the leading solution around this. And so it's still, I would say, early, but right now we've got a lot of incredible builders just solving some of the biggest problems in the space. And the challenge with this industry is because Bitcoin and crypto sort of lead the way, it creates a lot of hype at some point. So right now we still, I think, have a pretty strong foundation. As Bitcoin keeps going up, it becomes more and more hype, more people come in to this, take advantage of people, and then obviously as people get hurt, it starts to correct, right? And that's like a challenge that I think we've got to go through in this space. But the more we can help people be educated and know what they're doing and understand the risks around that, I think that sort of helps and protects everyone as a whole, and it helps our industry sort of mature and sort of advance compared to how it was working.
Absolutely. I think the onus, to a large extent, does fall on the builders and the people who are working in the space to make sure that the narrative is being set right so that the perception around the industry changes and changes for the better. And that brings me to the books that you have written. You have authored around three books and you have them to your name. Can you tell us a little about them? Where can folks order them from if they'd like?
Yeah, happy to. So you're indeed correct. I published three books. It was a little while ago. But the objective around these books was really to help people, right? To not make the same mistakes that I made. And actually, the first book, when I was graduating from the University of Toronto, the president and one of the other sort of governors of the university was like, "Hey, you've got a ton of experience. Why don't you consider writing something for University of Toronto students?" And so I started writing something and then ran it by them, and they said, "Hey, well, this doesn't really make sense just for University of Toronto students. Why don't you make it for Canadian students?" And then I made some changes, updated it, and then when I went back, they were like, "Why is this for Canadian students? Why don't you just publish this and open up to all students, because they would really benefit from this," right? And so that's sort of how it evolved. So I never planned to be an author, but that was sort of the way it sort of worked out. And the main thing was being able to create value and help people. And that's in part even why, I mean, you can order them on Amazon. I mean, you can also get them for free on different sites as well. And the objective here is not to make money on it, but really to help people to learn from my mistakes, and hopefully to not make all the same ones, right? And sort of as a whole get better, faster, stronger as a society. And so that was the sort of the way the first one went. The second two were basically similar idea. One was post-graduation, sort of going out into the in the real world and sort of navigating the world and all the different challenges along the way there. And so that was part of the second one. And then there was also one where I wrote it with four medical doctors and sort of covered certain aspects on more around leadership, et cetera. So I'm obviously not a medical doctor, but brought in and had a number of experts that cover all of that. And that was something that you know, has done quite well for the medical, you know, community or doctor or aspirant. So that's those are sort of the three. You know, the big thing here, and I think what I hope others do is, you know, as you, you know, have challenges and mistakes that you make, try to help others, right? Try to help others, you know, not make those same mistakes. Try to, you know, pass it on, you know, however you can. Cause I think at the end of the day, like, these are the things that I think really have a huge impact on people, right? And they're going to remember.
Absolutely.
And they're going to know, and you know, it, you know, you pass it forward, right? So.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I love what you've said. And I think this is something that I, you know, say a lot as well in my public speaking, that I would like people to learn from my mistakes and not make them, and go ahead and make their own, because that is the only way that, you know, we move forward and move forward a little faster. So it's a wonderful space. Again, here in Web3, I feel everybody is open to, you know, lend a helping hand. And it's a very collaborative community. And even in the larger scheme of things, I think if we are pulling someone up with, you know, just with the solutions to the struggles that we have seen, we are adding value. And that is wonderful in itself.
Okay.
So, you know, unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I've come to the time mark that we had set for this particular recording. But this has been such a wonderful conversation. I would love to know, from you, like, do you have any advice for the builders who are just starting off right now, or just users, even, you know, just general users who are perhaps, they have a certain perception of Web3 currently, and what would be your perhaps suggestions for these users as well as builders for them to truly start living on blockchain?
Yeah, so I mean, at the end of the day, for the builders, I mean, you got to truly be passionate about something, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we think that, you know, we usually recommend try to talk to 30 people as potential customers or around the space that can help you and guide you and figure out, like, do you have something that'll have product market fit before you fully build it, right? Or at least sort of expect a product market fit and expect there to be a real need for this, right? In terms of the users, I think one of the things that, you know, sometimes surprises me is, you know, you go to all these conferences, you can learn a lot, but you oftentimes, like, you know, leave a 2-day conference or 3-day conference and you still have never, you know, maybe even used blockchain or used crypto or any of this stuff. And so the best thing you can do is, like, test it out, right? Like, try a few different products, try a few different games. Don't go risk a bunch of money, but even with like $1, $2, like, you don't need a big amount, but go, like, learn on some of the stuff firsthand, right? Like, you're going to learn a lot more trying out a couple of these things and sort of starting to make a decision for yourself, an opinion for yourself on the technology and parts of the technology, rather than maybe going to a conference for 3 days and, like, not ever having tried it. Obviously, there's both aspects. You still want, like, that knowledge base. But I think both go very well hand in hand. And I find oftentimes that part of actually trying stuff out, testing it out, experimenting is sometimes lost.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true. People have, at times they are very risk averse, but like you said, you know, you need to get your hands dirty a little bit, get involved. And that is when you truly understand the technology and you can get involved in a way that is actually making your life a little better as well.
Yes, absolutely.
So once again, thank you so much for making the time to speak to me today and to our listeners. I think this has been such an insightful conversation for builders and users alike. Any parting words before we wrap this up?
Just keep it up and keep building. And I think from some of those stories that I shared as well, I mean, even
yeah.
if people don't necessarily see the vision, I think, you know, make sure that, you know, you continue to follow what you're trying to do. Obviously, stay coachable, make sure that, like, there is a big opportunity there, but you know, keep building, and let's make the world a better place.
Absolutely, I couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much once again for joining and speaking to us today. This has been a great chat.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.